So this is joint work with Lucas Ballard, Fabian Monrose, and Gerald Mason, and we're looking at ways that an observer can identify the language that is spoken in encrypted voice over IP. So for start off with a little bit of background, I'm sure everybody in this audience is aware of the rising popularity of voice over IP recently, and I'm sure everyone understands the reasons for this too. Of course, it's really cheap, especially compared to landlines for international calls. It actually sounds pretty good, and it offers at least the potential for better security. Because with standard IP networking, when you're sending voice, it's just like any other data, right? And we have nice off-the-shelf crypto routines for doing encryption and authenticity. And in fact, there's a special purpose protocol, the Secure Real-Time Transport Protocol, that you can think of sort of like SSL for real-time traffic. And so with this, intuitively, you would think that if you encrypt your data with strong crypto, that you would be safer from any type of eavesdropping or snooping. Unfortunately, we found that you still need to be careful because there are still some threats that remain, even for encrypted traffic. And particularly, the threat that I'm talking about today is that a crafty observer in the network could look at the stream of encrypted packets that you're sending and use the characteristics of that traffic to identify the language you're speaking. Now, to put our work in context with some other research, in the 1990s, there was a lot of work on identifying spoken languages directly from audio. And a lot of that centered around these evaluations carried out every few years by NIST. More recently, there's been work on privacy and voice over IP. Wang and others looked at VoIP calls going through some low latency mixing anonymizing network like Tor and found that using timing, they could identify the true source and destination IPs. And finally, most recently, there's been research into similar types of information leakage attacks to what we've done using other types of streaming media like video. And we're all looking forward to hearing about that in the next talk. So to overview the rest of my talk, I'll start off with talking about why this type of leakage is possible and when you might be vulnerable. I will start off developing some intuition and then do some exploratory data analysis to get some sort of evidence to back up that intuition. And then I'll talk about how an attacker could use this leakage to automatically identify languages. And finally, we'll wrap up with talking about a couple of different straightforward countermeasures and whether or not they could do a good job of protecting us. So first, let's develop some intuition. When you think about a real-time protocol like VoIP, there's a lot of design decisions that go into making sure that you make efficient use of your network resources so that you minimize packet losses and delays. And one technique that we think will be increasingly attractive in the future is the use of variable bitrate codecs. And the way these work is that when you go to compress a few milliseconds of speech, you first do some analysis to determine if that type of sound is very complicated or if it's very important to the way humans perceive speech. And if so, you'll allocate a lot of bits to it to get a nice high fidelity representation so it'll sound really good. On the other hand, if the sound isn't very complicated or it's not very important to the way humans hear speech, then you can get away with sending only a few bits and send a very small packet out and be very efficient. And for example, the codec we're looking at, which is Speaks, in VBR mode uses 9 different bit rates, so it generates 9 different packet sizes on the wire. And the advantages of this type of coding is, of course, that you can get improved sound quality for a given load on your network, or you can significantly reduce the load that you put on the network for the same sound quality. The price, of course, is that you have to do this additional processing to determine what bit rate you need to use for each packet. And that cost is going to go down significantly as processors get faster and faster. The other main design decision is that for encryption, generally for streaming traffic, you want to use a really fast, nice stream cipher that'll leave the size of the packet basically unchanged and not add any additional load on your network. But unfortunately, when these two techniques are used together, they generate sort of this perfect storm of information leakage. And an adversary can, in fact, use this to learn about what you're saying, even though your conversation's encrypted. So to sort of see how this works graphically, we have Alice here speaking into her microphone, and her VoIP program records what she's saying as this waveform. And then using the codec at regular intervals, it'll generate a packet, and then it'll use the crypto layer to come along and lock everything down and take out all the information, ideally, and make it safe that she can send these packets out across the network to Bob, who can decrypt and then decompress and listen to them. But in the situation that I'm talking about today, where we have not only variable bitrate compression, so we have these different sized packets, but we also have a crypto layer that preserves the lengths of the packets you see that there's this relationship between the audio from Alice and the packets that we see on the wire. And in fact, this relationship goes both ways, right? So the stream of packets that we see on the wire tells us something about what it sounded like when Alice was talking. Now, to see an even better representation of this and to see how strong the relationship is, we need to look at a better representation of this sound than just the waveform. So what we'll use here is a spectrogram. And we have this plotted above the waveform here. On both graphs, we have time on the x-axis. And what the spectrogram is, for each point in time, we have this column vector of pixels that show the energy at a bunch of different frequencies. So low frequencies at the bottom and high frequencies towards the top. And at each pixel, if there's not very much energy at that point in time at that frequency, then the pixel is a nice cool color, like a blue or a green. On the other hand, if there's a lot of energy there, then the pixel will be a hot color like a red or an orange. And you can see some sort of relationship here between the amplitude of the waveform and the energy at various frequencies. And you can see that, in fact, there's a lot more information in the spectrogram than in the waveform. And in fact, a trained expert in speech can look at one of these and read off what the person said. So to see the relationship between the sound and the bit rate, and which tells us the size of the packets that we'll see on the wire, we can color code the waveform to show how big the packets will be at each point in time. And then we can take one of these, for example, the red regions, and pull those columns out to see what those type of packets will sound like. So here we have some representative sample of what it sounds like when speech is encoding at 18.2 kilobits a second. And we can do this for a lot of speech, and then we can take these column vectors of pixels and we can sort them by energy. So on the left we have packets that don't carry much sound at all, and on the right we have packets that carry sound with a lot of energy at a lot of different frequencies. And this graph gives us sort of an idea of what packets of that size sound like, if you can think of that. And in fact, we can do this for all the 9 different bit rates. And here we've got 3 examples. So you can contrast the little packets encoded at a very low bit rate on the left, 250 bits a second, with packets that are going to be very big because they were encoded at a high bit rate of 24.6 kilobits a second on the right. And you can see that just by knowing how big the packets are, we know, in fact, quite a bit about what that period of sound is going to sound like. So hopefully with this, I've shown you that this relationship between the audio and the encrypted packet size is real, and that it would leak a significant amount of information about what's being said. But I haven't yet shown you any reason to believe that this is necessarily going to give away the language that's being spoken. And to do that, we're going to need to look at some data. So we used a corpus from the Oregon Graduate Institute. It has data from about 70 to 100 native speakers of 21 different languages, and it's been used extensively in the speech processing community to do studies on language identification using audio directly. The 21 languages in this data set come from all around the world, all around Europe, various parts of Asia, the Middle East, Africa, most of the languages from the Americas. So we think this gives a pretty good representative sample of the languages that we would see in phone calls all around the world. Another nice thing about it is that the actual speech that we have represented here, we think is a pretty good sample of what we would hear people talking about in phone calls all around the world. So we have people, the way this data set was collected is the OGI researchers set up basically an answering machine, and participants could call in, and the machine would prompt them to speak on a certain topic, and then it recorded their response, and the responses are what we have in the data set. And so we have people talking about the room they're sitting in or what they just recently ate. Especially appealing for us is we have 60 seconds from each user where they're encouraged to make up a story or talk about anything else completely at random for a minute. And so we think this is a nice, good representation of real types of speech. So we took this data from all 21 languages, and we compressed it with the Speaks codec, and we looked at how often each bit rate got used to encode each language. And we see that, in fact, there's significant differences here. So if you look at the highest peak, that represents 18.2 kilobits a second, you see that bit rate is used a lot more for Mandarin than it is to encode Russian. Similarly, you can see a big difference between how often the smallest bit rate here is used to encode Indonesian versus how often it's used for Czech. And in fact, this probability distribution over these bit rates that will lead to a probability distribution over packet sizes serves as sort of a fingerprint for the language. And in fact, we can use this. We can get even a more detailed more fine-grained representation, if we look at the probability distribution over not only just one packet at a time, but say strings of three packets in a row, so 3 grams, or strings of four packets in a row, 4 grams. More generally, we're going to use the probability distributions of these n-grams of packets to identify the language. So now that I've given you a flavor for how this attack can be pulled off, we'll talk about how an adversary might automate this and be able to identify languages in practice. So the setup for our experiment is that we have two machines on our network playing the role of Alice and Bob. We have the Alice machine, which takes a WAV file from this 21-language data set and uses some open-source VoIP software to play it across the network to Bob. And this generates a stream of variously sized packets on the network in between. We have our eavesdropper here, Eve, who knows what these frequency distributions over the n-grams of packet sizes look like for a whole bunch of different languages. And if she can capture packets from this network between Alice and Bob, using TCP dump, for example, then she can observe the frequencies of these n-grams in Alice's conversation. And then she can compare that to each of the probabilities for the languages that she knows about. And then finally, she can assign the newly observed speech to the language whose distribution is most similar to the language to what she sees on the wire. So in this case, she can correctly infer that in fact Alice is speaking Swedish. Now, for Eve to do this, she needs two things. She needs to know these n-gram probability distributions for all the different languages in her data set. She could get those by, for example, getting a data set like we got and playing it over a network and observing the frequency distributions there. She also needs some way to compare the frequency distributions she sees in packets on the wire to what she knows about for each of these languages. And one way we've developed that she could use for that is to first look at all these frequency distributions for all the languages that she knows about. And if any of the n-grams has a probability that it varies too much within a language on average, or it doesn't vary enough between languages, she can decide that, well, it's not going to be very useful for telling a difference between languages, so she'll just ignore that one. And then, using the n-grams that she finds to be useful, she can use the chi-squared test statistic as a measure of the similarity of the distribution of n-grams that she sees on the wire to the distribution that she knows about for the language. And then simply, of course, she'll assign the new speech to the language that's most similar under this metric. So to see how well this works, we applied this classifier on all the speech from our 21-language data set, and we used the standard leave one out cross-validation technique to see how well it works. And here's our results. This is a confusion matrix, and it shows on the x-axis the language that the speaker was really speaking. And on the y-axis is the language that the classifier thought it was. We start off with a plain white background, and when we classify a speaker of language X into language Y, we make the cell at grid position XY just a little bit darker red. So what we'd like to see is a nice dark red line across the diagonal and nothing anywhere else. We see parts of that pattern here, right? So for example, for Tamil, the cell on the diagonal there is a lot darker than any of the other ones. So we see that for speakers of Tamil, we identify their language correctly about 40% of the time. On the other hand, some other languages like Cantonese, for example, we don't do very well on. So the cell on the diagonal there isn't really any darker than any of the other ones. So another perspective may be to ask instead of how often do we identify the language correctly on the first try, we'll ask how many guesses does it take us to find the right answer. So here we can show that with the CDF. On the x-axis we have the number of guesses that we've had so far, and on the y-axis we have the probability that we found the correct answer. And of course, if we had no information and were forced to guess uniformly at random, we'd see a diagonal line like this. But even for the language which our classifier does worst on, which is Arabic, we see that after 3 guesses, it's doing significantly better than random. For the language we do the best on, which is Indonesian, we're getting over 40% accuracy on the first try. And on average, for all the languages, we're doing about 3 times better than random on the first guess, and after 4 guesses out of 21 possible choices, we've found the correct answer half the time. Again, I'll stress that these results are significantly better than random and a lot better than an observer should be able to do when the traffic is supposed to be encrypted. But we can do even better. Because when you think about we have 9 different packet sizes and we're looking at 3 grams. That gives us 9 to the third, 729 different n-grams that we need to get good estimates for the frequencies of, right? And to do that, we're going to need several minutes of speech, more than we really have. We have about 2 minutes of good speech from each user in our data set. But if we had fewer of these n-grams, we could do a better job of getting good, accurate estimates of their frequencies from a new conversation. And so to do that, we'll look again at the types of sounds that are encoded with each different packet size. And so we have here the graphs for the sounds encoded with each packet size, starting from small packets on the top left to the biggest packets on the bottom right. And the first thing we observed was that in the Speaks codec, just from the way it works, we know that the two smallest packets are used basically for the same thing. These guys encode periods of time where there's no speech at all or there's no sound at all. And so since they play essentially the same functional role, we can group them together and consider them to be the same thing. Similarly, you might assign other packet sizes together. For example, you might put the other three on the top line together, and you might put the four on the bottom line together. But when we look at the n-gram frequencies of the packets that come before and after, it makes more sense to put the largest packet size by itself and to put the six remaining packet sizes into one group. And with that, we're able to improve our results significantly for most of these languages. So here's the confusion matrix that we had before. And with our improvement, we see that most languages were able to accurately recognize much more than before. On the other hand, there's this set of six languages that gives us some trouble. For Arabic, Czech, Spanish, Swahili, Tamil, and Vietnamese, a lot of times when we see those speakers, we think that it's Hungarian or Hindi. And we think that the reason for this increased confusion is that some of these packet sizes that we just grouped together, because they're not very good for telling most of the languages apart, actually, they are pretty useful for distinguishing among these six or eight. Again, we can look at the CDF, and here's how we did before. And then with the reduced dimensionality, our results are again much improved for most languages. So on average, we're getting about 66% of the speaker's language identified correctly on the first try. Well, with that done, another question that's often asked in studies in the speech processing community is, how well can we do when we already have it narrowed down to two choices for the language? So applications for this in VoIP would be if we know where a call originates and where it terminates. Then we might know that it's either probably the language in the caller's country or the language in the receiver's country. Also, we might know who is speaking. And maybe we know that they speak one language for work and one language to their family, and so we want to know who they're talking to. So with our data set of 21 different languages, we get about 420 pairs of languages that we can run this type of test on. And for most of them, we do quite well. For example, for Portuguese and Korean, or Farsi and Polish, we actually achieve 100% accuracy on this data set. We also have one that our friends at the government agencies might get a kick out of. We get about 98% accuracy on Farsi versus English. On the other hand, there are some language pairs where we don't do so well. For example, when you remember a couple slides back, when we saw speakers of Czech, usually we thought it was Hungarian. So when we try to distinguish those two, we don't do so well. But overall, on average, we do better than 86%. And hopefully this, together with the results from the more challenging 21-way test, are enough to convince you that this is a real threat and that an observer in the network could, in fact, identify the languages that are spoken with a high degree of accuracy, and that perhaps we should do something about this. So next, let's talk about what should we do. So to really stop this information from leaking, we need to remove the relationship between the sound that's encoded in a packet and the size of that packet when it's encrypted and sent out over the wire. Broadly, there's two straightforward approaches that first come to mind. The first one is to use padding and to change the sizes of the packets as we're sending them out so that the original information is somewhat obscured. And the easiest way to do this is probably to switch from a stream cipher to a block cipher so that the sizes of the packets that go out will be rounded up to the next multiple of the block size. And so we tried this on our data set with several different block sizes to see how well it would work at degrading the classifier's accuracy. Again, here's how we do with no information at all shown in the diagonal line in yellow and with no padding with our technique in red. And so with a block size of 128 bits, the performance really isn't degraded very much at all. With a bit larger block, say 192 or 256 bits, the classifier's accuracy is reduced significantly, But there's still a lot of information that leaks because we still get the right answer, say 25 or 30% on the first try. So that's not acceptable either. Finally, when we use a much bigger block of 512 bits, all the packets wind up being the same size, and we really do have no information, and so the results that we get really statistically aren't significantly different from random. The downside to this technique is that with padding, we wind up adding a lot of bytes to our traffic for really no purpose other than fooling this type of analysis. And when we pad enough for it to really be effective, we wind up adding a lot of these bytes. And this may be okay from the perspective of a single user that maybe only talks over VoIP every once in a while, but from the perspective of a system designer or a network administrator, from our perspective, that is, this really may not be so acceptable, especially if you think about some organization that wants to switch all of its users from traditional landlines to VoIP. Now you've got a 42% increase in the load of your real-time high-priority packets, and that may not be acceptable. As well, I should mention, in that case, you're really missing out on all the nice benefits of the VBR codec that you wanted to use in the first place. So then from the perspective of the single user, if you know that you're going to have to send out these big packets anyway, well, you might as well use those extra bits instead of just padding with zeros and then encrypting. You can use those bits to encode a higher fidelity representation of the entire conversation. And so it seems like that's the way to go for a single user. On the other hand, all these packets are still going to be large, and you're missing out on the benefits of VBR. So maybe from the perspective of the administrator or the designer, it's still not attractive. To sort of wrap up here, through all this, we've seen again this sort of eternal trade-off between efficiency and privacy or security. It seems that in this case, you can either save bandwidth by using VBR, or you can be safe from information leakage. But the straightforward techniques don't seem to offer any way for us to have both at the same time. And that's really unfortunate. It's too bad. And so what we need to do in future work is to find some way to intelligently add just the right amount of padding at just the right times to be efficient, but still mask the identity of the language. Another question that this work brings up is, if we were able to identify these languages so accurately in encrypted traffic, how much more information might be given away? And might the problem, in fact, be much worse? That's all I have for right now, though. So thank you for listening, and I'll take questions.
Please use microphones and introduce yourself before you ask your question.
Hi, this is Yin Yamao from Qualcomm. You mentioned you used something like scalar quantization on the bitrate level. You have 9 levels, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if you can use, you know, vector quantization and get some statistical information out of that. Maybe that can do better.
So you're suggesting maybe a more sophisticated technique for grouping these packet sizes together.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Nikita Borisov, University of Illinois.
Hi.
So you noticed that your second classifier did much better on most languages, but whenever it identified things as Hungarian or Hindi, it was likely to be mistaken. So could you then pass that back, in those cases, pass it back to the first classifier to get the benefit of both? So if you identify something as Hungarian or Hindi, say, run for the first classifier, which has better accuracy.
So you're suggesting something like a more sophisticated classifier, like maybe 2 levels of classification.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a real potential. You could even envision something like a decision tree where you adaptively choose at each level what the best question to ask about the data is.
Right.
And, in fact, the results might be, there might be a lot of improvement that's possible. Right now in this work, we just wanted to show how easy it is to get quite a lot of information out. But yeah, that's a good idea too.
So what's the next information leak that you're going to look at? Because it sounds like there's a lot of information to stuff there. I mean, language sounds like one of the more boring.
Yeah, we're looking at a lot of things, so we don't really have anything to report yet. But stay tuned. Hopefully, we will soon.
How large were the are in terms of number of speakers of any given language are these data sets?
I think we had between about 70 speakers on the low end for a couple of languages, up to around 100 speakers for most of them.
So it's quite a lot.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the distribution of male and female is, but I think it's reasonable.
And when you were doing the statistical extraction, are you recognize the things that you're recognizing are elements of of the original data set?
Rather than
say de novo conversations that were not in the original data set.
What our hypothesis is, and our intent is with these 3 grams or 4 grams, is to get at patterns in the underlying languages where you have like one type of sound that's common in one language. For example, if you think of a language like German that tends to end on hard consonants sometimes versus like a Romance language that often ends in vowels. Ideally, that's what we're going after. And I think if the data set is a good representation of these languages, then hopefully that's what we've got. Does that answer your question?
No.
No? I missed it? Okay. No,
the question was the when you're doing your tests of the recognizer, you are using elements of the original data sets that you use to train.
Right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So for leave one out, the cross-validation, we take one speaker and we hold their data off to the side. We build all our models, and then we run the classifier on this one guy. And then we put him back in and take another user out and see how we do doing that on average.
Joe Pato, HP Labs. For the corpus, do you know if they were native speakers or if there was an effect of a foreign...
Yes, they were native speakers.
All right. Thanks. Bonjour. Je suis Ian Goldberg, the University of Waterloo.
Hi.
And so on that question, you use native speakers, but what do you think might happen trying to identify someone speaking with an accent, like a native Russian speaker speaking English? Would that throw off the n-grams?
Possibly. So there's a couple of questions that come to mind when you start thinking about non-native speakers. You might think of trying to distinguish native speakers of a given language from non-native speakers, maybe accent detection, or you could... what's the other?
Because one of your examples was someone who speaks one language to colleagues and one language to family.
Right, or yeah, or we... Oh, okay.
Right, so he's probably going to have an accent.
Right,
in one of those
our results in that case might not be quite as good if he's not a native speaker.
Right.
Potentially, yeah. But there's probably room for some interesting work to go forward on that topic as well.
Merci.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, I'm Jed Donnelly from Berkeley Lab. You seem kind of discouraged that it would be difficult to get both efficient bandwidth utilization and privacy. What about the possibility of trading off something else like jitter or latency, where you'd take the higher bandwidth sections and sort of spill them over and delay them a little bit? Did you consider that?
I hadn't really thought of it, but that could be nice too. One of the things for VoIP is it is a real-time protocol, so you... we'd like to get your packets there as quickly as possible, so adding any delay might degrade the call quality, but we might be to the point where those strategies would be nice too.
What do you think is the biggest threat of this information leakage? I mean, I suppose it would be useful for the CIA to determine if people were speaking Arabic,
yeah.
But Arabic is one of the harder languages to detect. It's interesting, but I'm wondering what the overall impact is.
So you could envision some government agency that wants to wiretap our traditional landline calls, and because they can't with encrypted VoIP, maybe they'll do this due to a sort of, I don't want to say racial profiling, but some sort of profiling of VoIP users to determine who gets additional scrutiny and who maybe they won't investigate further. I guess you could have... people detecting maybe a foreigner in on a hotel network or something. You determine this guy is from out of town. Maybe he's an easy mark for robbing his room or something.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My name's Lucas Ballard, as you know.
Hey.
So going back to the last question about jitter.
Yeah.
Would that really affect your accuracy? Because are you looking at the inter arrival time of packets?
No, we don't use timing at all. We use packet size. So if you were able to take some of the bytes from one packet and delay them a little bit and put them into the next packet, then that would mess up the sizes and it might throw us off a bit.
I guess it would be a lot harder, but related to one of the questions, have you thought about whether you could pick up dialects within a language? People from Boston versus California.
It's an interesting question, and I can't really say to what degree that would be harder or easier than what we've done, but it would definitely be fun to look at.
questions?